You are listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast. To learn more about Passion City Church, including our gathering times in Atlanta and Washington, D.C., visit us online at passioncitychurch.com. Today's talk comes from Pastor Ben Stewart.
Well, I've only been stabbed once. It was by my brother. We were in the back seat of the car when we were kids, and he had just gotten a hunting knife from my dad and had poked me in the leg with it, which I thought was uncalled for. And so I had that seat belt. It was one of those old cars where the seat belt in the middle is like the long strap with the big heavy metal end, you know, kind of like on airplanes. It makes a good whip, in theory, and I thought I would test that theory. So I grabbed it and just kind of wham, hit him with the metal part, and he poked me again with the knife. I'm like, how dare you? So I whipped him again, and he poked me with it, and I went to whip him again. He said, don't you do it. And I was like, he can't tell me what to do. He's not my dad. So I had to hit him again. And at that point, he just sunk a knife into my leg. And remember, I was like, ah! And then I remember my dad's driving. My brother's like, don't tell dad. I'm like, don't tell dad. He's right there. And I think the pool of blood on my jeans is going to be a giveaway. But you know, that's how we fought. He broke a mirror over my face at one point. I broke all his trophies in his bedroom. You know, things like that. My sister fought with us too, but she was a girl, so we didn't hit her. So that warfare was primarily psychological. But we always fought. Why? Because siblings fight. And then at mom's direct orders and threats, we would make up, and now we get along, right? Now, why do I mention this? Because it's not just biological siblings that fight. Christian brothers and sisters fight. And some of us know this. Some of us are like, what? What are you talking about? Just take it by faith. Sometimes that's happened, right? And throughout the centuries, it's occurred. Look in the Old Testament, look in the New Testament. In the New Testament, you saw the church almost rip apart along ethnic lines and along cultural lines between Jew and Gentile. And the leaders of the church were constantly pulling them back together. No, God has made us one family, right? You saw the church of Corinth. Paul wrote two letters to them telling them to love one another. That's where we get 1 Corinthians 13, the great love chapter. As you read in church history, though, they couldn't figure that out, and they split as a church. The church of Corinth had a church split. You see later that the church, the entire Christian church, split east and west. And if you look at the history of the church, the dirt in Europe is soaked with the blood of professing Christians who were murdered by other professing Christians. And America is the same way. I remember when I was in church history class, I had to read a book called The History of the Church in America and Canada. The Canadian chapters were very boring because whenever they disagreed, they just kind of talked and worked it out. American ones, we went to war against each other, right? Makes for entertaining reading, but a really sad reality about us. And so sad, the 17th century Jewish philosopher Spinoza said this about Christians. He said, I have often wondered that persons who make boast of professing the Christian religion, namely love, joy, peace, temperance, charity to all men, should quarrel with such rancorous animosity and display daily towards one another such bitter hatred. This, rather than their virtues, which they profess, is the readiest criteria of their faith. He says, when I look around, I say, you will know Christians because they're fighting each other. And lest we say that was something for centuries of old, it happens still today. One of the holy sites in Christianity is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. It's the traditional site where Jesus rose from the grave. They built a church of that empty tomb. And if you go there, there are different Christian factions that come to worship, and there's lines on the floor you're not meant to cross. And if you cross them, it was just a few years ago in the news, there was high media coverage because two groups of monks were coming into worship. One group of monks bumped the other group, and it became a full-on melee. And you can watch the video. Some monk comes flying in the back with a Superman punch. He's not that good at it, apparently. They're not training monks these days in hand-to-hand combat. It was a lot of slapping and hair pulling. It was a little ugly. But still, you look at that and you're like, wow, that's us. That's really embarrassing. And it happens in church circles too. It happens in cities like this. It happens when people come to me and I ask them if they go to a church and they have to whisper the name of their church. Like they're embarrassed to tell me, like, I actually go to a different church than yours. Like I'm supposed to go like, how dare you? You know, that we're supposed to war against each other? And yet there's that sense of competition sometimes. You've maybe felt it with other churches. Someone will tell you, I go to this church. And you're like, that's a great church if you like in authentic worship. Good luck with that. We'll pray for you guys. But it's fascinating how we can fight against each other. I'll tell you what, it happens all the time. And we quarrel. And let me tell you something. This chapter is going to be about why we fight. If you notice, James says, what causes fights and quarrels among you? Did you notice he assumes we have them? that we're going to fight each other. And so we're going to talk about why. And what I love about James is he's been hitting the branches of this the last couple of weeks, why we talk the way we talk, how we treat people of a different socioeconomic status. But these are all branches. And tonight he's going to get to the trunk. Here's your real issue. And then he's going to get to the roots. Here's your deeper issue. And then he's going to give us the remedy of how to fix it. That's where he's going. Let me show you your issue. Let me get underneath it and show you the roots of your issue. And then let me show you how to remedy the issue. Because we fight and we do it today. It's fascinating. The Greek word here we translate quarrel is actually Twitter. Isn't that weird? Like, no, it's not. But boy, we sure know how to fight each other though, don't we? And it's not meant to be this way. So James asks the question in verse 1. Here's the problem. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? He says, what's the cause? Think about it for a second. When you disagree with people, when there's animosity, when there's gossip and bickering and factions in your organization, how does that happen? What causes it? And what's interesting is you almost get the assumption that he's asking us the question, we're going to start naming people. Well, it's because Bob over there never shuts up, or it's because Susan's always late, or it's because Gina over there is a moron. We start to say things. But then he stops us and was like, no, no, no. What causes quarrels? What causes fights? He's like, let me tell you, is it not this? He says, is it not your passions at war within you? And it's interesting. He says, it's not the issue around you. It's an issue in you. And, you know, in Greek, there's two different you's. There's a singular you and there's a plural you. Greek has a y'all. That first one's a y'all. He says, what causes the fights among y'all? He says, it's the desires in you. He said, the real issue, what brings the fire to your fights? What brings all the emotional drama into your war with your roommate? What brings all those fights into your office that brings so much tension you can cut it with a knife? What brings the drama that divides churches, which happens all the time around the U.S. today? What brings all that drama? He says it's not even the external issue. It's an internal issue. It's not interpersonal. It's personal. It's the desires in you. And he uses the word hedone. It's where we get hedonism. I want what I want. And if I can't get what's good for me, I'm mad at you. And that's what he goes on to say. You desire and don't have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. And he does like a chiasm with it. What causes the fights and quarrels? It's your passions within you. You desire and you covet, so you quarrel and you fight. And he's telling you, these fights and quarrels are because of your desires. It's about you. Your biggest emotional dramas, if you look at what's fueling the flame, it's not the externals, it's inside of you. An easy test is to think about it this way. Just think about some emotional drama you've had driving. DC is ranked second worst driving city in America, ranked just above Baltimore, Maryland. That's a fact, hard data. I'm just preaching truth tonight. Some of you have been driving in DC after a full night's rest, maybe a healthy breakfast, and with hours before you need to get to your destination, and someone cuts you off. What do you do at that moment? You're like, that's silly. He must be new here. Oh my gosh. But if you're in an ideal state, you just let him go. But if you only have 4 hours of sleep and you're late and you're hungry and you're going to a meeting you don't want to get to and that guy cuts you off, what happens? What's the matter? You're a moron. You're a moron, right? Some of you light it up, right? I hear. You guys confess these things to me. I wouldn't know anything about this, but... Actually, my mom told me this like a day ago. She was like, you can tell these are your kids because I was driving the other day and they're all in their car seats in the back going, what's going on? Get there. Get there. Switch lanes, man. Move. Make it happen. My kids are like calling traffic shots and I'm like, easy, kids. You're right. But what's the difference? The externals haven't changed. Same guy, same cutting you off. Total different level of emotional energy invested in it. Why? Because of you. All that drama is coming out of you, right? You desire, you covet. I want what I want when I want it. And if I can't get it, I freak out. I remember when I used to wait tables. I worked at a Mexican food restaurant. And it was fascinating to me how mean people were until you gave them chips. And then they suddenly got nicer. And I was like, oh, you're like a baby. You were just whining like, and as soon as I fed you, you like chilled out. And you and I are that way. We want what we want when we want it. And if we can't get it, we pitch a fit, right? And he says, that's the problem. Your issue is not the issue. It's how you respond to the issue. That's what your mom used to say to you. When you and your siblings were fighting and yelling, she walked in the room. Why are you guys yelling? Well, she grabbed my hair, then she grabbed my love you. I don't care. Get along. Right? What was she saying? I don't care about the external issue. I want the way you treat each other to be different, right?
Because something's going on inside of you. And James is going to go on to say, there is no issue that necessitates a war in the Christian family. There is no issue that necessitates a war between us. But we'll do it sometimes. I remember from my seminary, it was famous. I wasn't there, but there was a theology class where they were discussing the differences between Calvinism and Arminianism. Arminianism is a form of soteriology that focuses more on human choice. Calvinism is a form of soteriology that emphasizes more God's sovereign control over all things. And they were discussing these theological positions, and that discussion became an argument. And at the end of that argument, in class, one guy hit the other guy. They just broke out in a melee in the middle of the classroom, which became a source of conversation at the seminary of like, what do you do now? And the joke around seminary was, well, you have to punish the Arminian because he had a free choice to hit the guy. You can't punish the Calvinist. He had to hit him, right? Didn't have a choice. A little theological humor. But it broke out into a full-on fist fight. But when Charles Simeon, a famous Calvinist preacher, met John Wesley, one of the greatest proponents of Arminian theology, when he first met him, he said, "Sir, I hear you are an Arminian, and I am a Calvinist." He said, "Yet before I draw my dagger, let me ask you a few questions." And they began to talk about the person of Jesus, the sufficiency of grace, his death and resurrection being what gives us a place in heaven. And he said, "Then at your consent, brother, let me put my dagger away, and let us first unite on the things that we agree." And you see that men that had some real differences, and real differences worthy of discussion, could still discuss it in a civil way. Maturity can lead to that civility. But for many of us, emotionally, we're more like babies. I desire, I covet, I want, so I pitch a fit. The problem is not out here, the problem's in here. So if you're in a fight with your roommate, you may have some real issues. Like if they're not paying rent, that's an issue. But does it necessitate a war? No. We can always speak to one another with civility. So if there's fights, if there's quarrels, if it's going crazy, there's something going on in you. There's a selfishness in you is what he'll say. That's what he was talking about earlier in chapter 3. He says, who is wise and understanding among you? He's asking that question, who's wise? It's like he's looking for a hand raise, like, me? I think I'm pretty wise. He's like, no, don't tell me that. He says, by your good conduct, show me through the works done with the humility that comes with wisdom. He said, you want to know who really wise people are? People who do beautiful things from a humble heart. And then he goes on to say that the works of wisdom are peaceable. And he's just drawing from the Old Testament. God, it says, when he created the world, that he created the world with wisdom. It says, by wisdom, the foundations of the planks of the earth were laid in Proverbs. And then it says, of wisdom, all her ways are peace. That word peace doesn't just mean the absence of conflict, but the presence of flourishing. You know someone's wise when they are humble and they're doing works that promote peace, that all of us win. They're using their gifts to help all of us flourish. And then he says, but if you're jealous or you're ambitious, you're something, but you're not wise. He says, don't boast about that and lie to the truth. He said, because watch, what's the fruit of jealousy and ambition? He says, disorder in every vile practice. God came into chaos and he brought order. And not an order that stifles, but an order that releases us to peace. But if you're jealous and ambitious, you create disorder. You disarray. And he says, that doesn't come from above. That is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. So if you're driven by your jealousy, I want my promotion. If you're driven by ambition, I want me at the front of the line. He says, you are a divider, not a uniter. You are a tearer down, not a builder up. You are going the opposite direction of God. The problem is not external, it's personal in you. Your selfish ambition will rip a community apart. And I know some of us hear that and you're like, wait, Ben, ambition's good. We're in DC. It's a city built on ambition. I'm here because I'm smarter and better than all the morons I left behind in high school, right? Is ambition good? Not the kind he's talking about. No. Because take it out of your line of work for a minute. Who do you love watching work? Just take it to another field. Let's take it into music. Do you like the person who is creating beautiful music because they love it? They love melody, they love tension and resolve, they love making something beautiful and sharing it with others so you can enjoy the beauty in the world. Or do you want someone that really doesn't care, they're just trying to write a hooky song so they can become famous and rich? Who do you want to cheer for? The person who's using their gifts to serve us, or the person who's trying to use us to build their own ambition? What about in acting? Do you like someone who just loves the craft of acting and really wants to embody a character, to tell a good story, to help you learn about the world and enjoy some time together? Or do you want someone that's just using a show so they can get famous? Who's easy to cheer for? The person who's writing a policy because they believe that policy can really create common good for humanity? Or the person who really doesn't care what policy they support, just as long as it gives them the control of power in government? Selfish ambition's ugly, and you don't need it to be successful. Successful people take the gifts God gave them and use them with humility and wisdom to create peace in an organization so we all flourish. But where you see jealousy and ambition, me first, it gets ugly. You see it in your own office. No one in here is like, you know what I love about Bob in our office? I love the way he'll just shiv anybody to get ahead. You know what I mean? He'll stab you in the back. He's always elbowing us out. He'll talk bad about you. He'll torpedo your career. You just got to respect that kind of vile serpentine jealousy. It's really a beautiful ambition. No, that's a hard guy to cheer for. That's an ugly thing. And it's coming from inside of you. And James says, hey man, that doesn't have any place, particularly in the church. He's saying that in the church is going the opposite way of God. God is building something and you're following the devil. And that word diabolos is literally to judge through, to cut through things. You're a divider. So let me tell you, if you want to destroy a church, let me give you some advice. If that's your goal, if you're like 2020, what's my new goal? Destroy Passion City Church. Let me tell you how to do it. What you want to do is you want to first get some selfish ambition in a pan. You know what I mean? Just like, how do I take control? How do I get power for me? And you want to just get that on a low simmer, all right? Just kind of get it boiling a little bit of like, it's just always percolating there. How do I get more glory for me? I want them to know and fear my name. You want that kind of stuff. And then what you want to do is you want to add some jealousy. Start looking around at seeing who has influence you don't, who gets attention you don't, who gets glory and praise you don't. And then what you want to add to that jealousy is resentment, all right? Not just wish you had that thing from that person, but really resent the giftings they have. Really resent the influence they have. Really resent their existence as a human being. You really want to just let it congeal into resentment. And then you want it to start to bubble over, but it usually doesn't bubble over with you throwing a punch. Usually it's got to start a little bit more passive than that, like a low boil of like an eye roll when they speak. Stuff like that, where anytime they talk, you're like, and then over time, you're passive aggressive enough, you want to keep an eye out for other people who might join you in that. And what you want to do is when you eye roll, look for other people who eye roll and be like, I know, right? Here she goes again. All right. And you really want to just kind of create a secret alliance with people that will tear apart other people. And then what you do is you begin to whisper about how come that person always gets to lead? How come that person always gets to speak? How come that person's this? What is someone I got to do to get some control around here? What does someone have to do to get on stage around here? Why do these people always like this? And you want to create a secret little alliance, and then you want other people to join it. Well, this isn't this. Well, that person's not authentic. Well, this guy's fake. Well, that's not enough. I don't think these guys are really feeding us. And you want to really kind of bubble that up. And then what you want to do is you want to get an us in contradistinction to them, and you want to really stir discontent, and you want to assume bad motives around them, and then congratulations, you're doing a great job of ripping a church apart. And let me tell you something, I've seen that a lot. Most churches die in America that way. Most don't die from external pressure. Well, we're just worshiping God and someone charged the gates. That's not really how it happens. It happens when they're torn apart from within. And what tears us apart? It starts inside of you. A selfish ambition about me leads me, rather than to serve you, I want to tear you down. I remember when I first began in ministry, when I was a youth pastor, I had a guy that when I walked into my new youth group, it had already existed, but it didn't have a youth pastor. It just had some adult workers. I walked in and there was just a handful of kids and a couple adults. And I remember when I walked in, one of the adults looked at me and said, how old are you, boy? I was like, 21. He was like, boy, I got underwear older than you. I was like, ew, like what? What does that even mean? But he's saying this in front of all the kids and stuff. I'm like, oh, okay, well, open your Bibles to Philippians, you know, and there just felt like there was this power struggle. And not long after that, he tried to get me fired and then kept trying to get me fired and then kind of created an alliance of adults that would speak badly around me. And they just kept trying to get me removed for all these different reasons they'd come up with. And then after a while, when they realized the pastor wasn't going to fire me, they just tried to start their own thing. And I remember in the middle of all that, at one point, I was just trying to get to know him because I was building resentment against this guy. And I'll never forget the day he called me on the phone. He said, you know what? I'm leaving the church. And I asked him why. And I felt terrible. I'm like, this guy helped launch the church. And I'm driving him out. I didn't know how to solve that. And I was like, man, you don't need to leave. Why are you doing that? And he was like, here's the end of the day, Ben. And I loved this honesty. He said, when I walk in the room, I want him to know my name and I want him to celebrate me. And with you around, they're just not going to do that. So I need to move on. A lot of people think that. Not a lot of people say it out loud. And when he said that, I said, I really appreciate your honesty. And yeah, you probably do need to move on. Because if that's what you're going for, let me build my kingdom. That's not what we're building here. This is God's kingdom, not any human being's kingdom. And if you're trying to use his kingdom to build yours, that's not a good thing. And so James will go on and say, you don't have because you don't ask. Some of you, you're not advancing much because you haven't even gone to supplication. You don't pray. It's just manipulation. How do I get ahead? How do I get power? How do I get authority? How do I get the seat of influence? How do I do that? You do it in your social sphere, you do it in your work context, or you even try to do it in church. And God doesn't want to bless that. He doesn't love shameless self-promotion. And then he says, when you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. You're trying to marshal heavenly resources for your earthly purposes. God, redeploy your resources from building your kingdom to build mine. How can he sign off on that? It's interesting. I read a quote today that said, if all your prayers were answered, every prayer you've prayed was answered, would it change the whole world or just change your world? And that's what James is talking about here. What's going on in your heart? He's trying to open it up. The problem is not out here. The problem's in here. There's something wrong with you. It's personal. And then what's interesting is you think James would move on from that and say, so here's the deal. Love each other. Be nice to each other. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it. Things like that, stuff that fits on coffee mugs and such. You think he would just go to kind of some moral adjustment, but he doesn't do that. He's identified the problem. You got a selfish ambition in you. But then he goes even deeper and says, your problem's not just personal. Your problem's theological. Your problem's not with that roommate that won't pay rent. Your problem's not with that person who got the promotion you didn't, even though they're not as smart as you. Your problem isn't the person here who's not giving you the authority you want in the church. Your problem is with God. That's what he says in verse 4. You adulterous people. And why does he call us that? Because all through the Old Testament, God calls himself a husband. Isaiah 54, he says, your maker is your husband. Jeremiah 3, he says, like a woman unfaithful to her husband, you've been unfaithful to me. And he says, you adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world is enmity towards God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Now, he's not saying you shouldn't have non-Christian friends. You absolutely should. The Bible's so clear on that. But he's talking about a mentality and a system. If you have a worldly mentality, which is I got to build my kingdom for my power and my glory. He says, that's not where we're going. We're building his kingdom for his power and his glory. So if you're in his kingdom trying to build your kingdom, that's weird. That's like being married to him and trying to date somebody else. We don't like that. We tend to frown on that, right? That when you say, hey, if you're married to me, don't date them. That's not an inappropriate request, right? And so here he's saying, man, for you to say, I worship you, God, glory to you only. But then you're dating popularity on the side. That I'm singing praises to God on Sunday, but on Monday through Friday, I'm just trying to boost my Instagram followers. Say, hey, man, I'm all about seeing glory to God just as long as it's coming through me and they know my name too. Man, if you're worshiping God but sliding into the DMs of self-promotion, God says, I don't like that. I don't want you to do that. Don't say you're all mine, but then try to build your kingdom that you're going the opposite direction. That's why he says in verse 5, don't you suppose, or do you suppose it's for no purpose? Scripture says he yearns jealously over the spirit he made to dwell in us. He is jealous for you. And it's interesting. Let me clarify. Some people hear that and they're like, man, I don't like the thought of a jealous God. Let me clarify. It was actually interesting. Oprah said as much. I listened to an interview of her years ago where she was talking about why she quit going to church. And she said, I listened to a sermon where he said, God is jealous. And she said, when I heard that, I thought, that kind of God has to be so small. You have such a petty God if he's jealous of you. And I walked away from that. And what's tragic to me about that, it was a misunderstanding of this text, right? It's not talking about a petty, insecure God. He's stalking you at night, driving around to see where you're going with your friends. That's not what's happening here. He's jealous in a healthy way, the way a husband is to a wife or a wife is to a husband. It's not wrong for a wife who's covenanted with a husband to ask of that man that he not date other women. That's not wrong. She's appropriately jealous. He is my husband, so he can't date you. He belongs to me. Say my name, right? You need to know me and not them. And it's the same with the man. It's appropriate for him to say, hey, if this is my wife, I don't want her dating somebody else, right? There's an appropriate level of jealousy. Now, again, there's an unhealthy jealousy, and that's not what he's promoting here. God is not an unhealthy, manipulative person. What he's saying here is if you belong to God, he doesn't want you chasing building your kingdom while he's building his. He wants you to be a part of what he's doing. He wants you to be a part of what he has for your life. That's what he's building here. And adultery is not a great thing in anyone's world. It's meant to be something we move away from, right? Now, here's what's fascinating about that. So far, this sermon hasn't been very fun at all. You're like, wow, welcome to Passion City Church, you adulterous people. James has been pushing us. Your problem is you want to advance you. And you want to advance you in contradistinction of God. Your problem's personal and your problem's theological. That I want to control my life. I want to be king. I want to be in power. I want to be in charge. That's a dangerous mentality. And he says, God can't bless that. Now, here's the thing. He's pushing us to confess that. What James wants us to do is admit that this is our problem. But a lot of us don't want to do that. You know why we don't want to do that? Because in our culture today, to confess, we're worried. If I say that, man, I am all about myself. I am seeking my glory. I have been about advancing me. I've been rude to my coworkers. I've been rude to my roommates. I've been jealous and gossipy in this church because I'm trying to advance myself. We feel like if we admit that in a culture like today, if you admit weakness, man, you get eaten alive. If you say, I am that way, people will say, I knew it. And you make me sick. You dirty, dirty, selfish, weak person. And then what comes next? Banishment. Get out of our sight. You're canceled. You are removed. You must be out of my view. You disgust me. Confession is going to lead to destruction. If I confess I'm a mess, I'm going to get buried in this world. So I got to act like I got it all together. That's what we're saying. But that's not the way the gospel works. And what I love about it is you think James is going to come harder. He says, you adulterous people, you're violating your very commitment with God and you expect to feel all this shame. But I love it in verse 6. He says, but he gives more grace. He's more gracious than you are selfish. He's more loving than you are insecure. And so what James is saying is, I want to push you to confess, yeah, I've been selfish personally. I've been defiant theologically because confession doesn't lead to destruction. Confession leads to redemption. The minute we admit we're weak, God comes rushing in. That's what he says. God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. God wants you to confess, not to destroy you, but to redeem you. As soon as we say that, I've been going the wrong direction. He loves to grab you and move you the right direction. And not just move you the right direction. He wants to shower grace into your life. I want to bless you. I want to help you be all that you're meant to be under God. I'm not trying to hurt you. I'm trying to rescue you from a destructive selfishness. No one likes being around selfish people. But humble people who use their gifts to good, we exalt people like that because that's what our God does. He opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And let me just say this as a church, we don't want to be a proud church. I told our staff that all the time. Hey, if we start to experience success as a church, if we start to grow, I do not want us, when we begin to grow, begin to say, yeah, that's right. Because we are Passion City Church. Say our name. Believe it, son. I was like, the minute we do that, this text says, not only will God stop blessing us, he will walk around the other side and oppose us. He will not work on our behalf. How can he bless people who say the name of Jesus but are really trying to promote themselves? He can't bless that. He can't unleash any power to that. So not only can he not bless it, he's going to oppose it. And I said, who wants to build a church that God opposes? Hey, we got a wonderful church here. God is opposing us and actively working against us, but we're going to use demon power to see what we can get done. No one wants to lead a church like that. But if we come in humble and say, God, we need you to move, man, his grace rushes in. And his grace is powerful. He can forgive anybody. He can redeem anybody. He can use anybody, even a selfish person like me. So I remember when I first started speaking, speaking can be a fairly insecure thing to do. You're standing up here talking to everybody and you can see everybody's face. I can tell who's totally with me and I can tell who's totally not, right? I'm with it. I can see it. And let me tell you something. When you're young, that's a bit of a rattling thing to do, be a position to be in. So I remember for me, when I would begin to write sermons early on, I would have an enormous amount of anxiety at the beginning of sermons. I mean, pacing in the green room, like freaking out, like trying to get my words out. And I just had all this incredible emotional energy around a sermon. I was making myself nuts. And I would try to take all that energy into, I got to get these words just right. I got to get this story just right. I got to get this thing just right. And then one day I was like, dude, I am not having any fun. I think God built me to preach, but this isn't fun. And so I finally asked at one point, I was like, let me analyze this. I was like, God, what am I so anxious about? And I paused from the sermon for a minute and was like, what am I so anxious about? And then I asked myself, am I anxious that God won't get glory? Like, is that my fear? I'm just so worried that you won't be glorified tonight. Like, if I don't present this word exactly right, like if I don't make my points rhyme, then they won't believe the Bible and then they won't go to heaven when they die. It'll be my fault because I didn't make it creative enough. Like, am I really worried that God won't be glorified? No, God gets glory. He spoke through a donkey in the Old Testament. He can use anybody. He can use me. It's not an issue of God's glory. And then I was like, then what am I so anxious about? And what I realized is my worry is not about whether or not God will get glory. It's about whether or not I will get glory. What I was nervous about is I wanted you to like me. I wanted you to think I was funny. I wanted you to think I was cool. I wanted you to think I was wise. I thought you wanted to think I was profound. I was worried about myself. And I realized that selfish ambition was tearing me apart on the inside. My problem was personal. And it was theological. That's what got me, is what I realized is I started to picture what I do in work as if I'm trying to shine a spotlight on Jesus Christ. Like the point of a sermon is to point you to him. And I just got this picture of Jesus in the spotlight. And what I was trying to do is just maybe duck my head in a little bit. Right? And try to sneak in a little bit like, hey, what's up, y'all? And try to get some attention on me. And I thought, that's so ridiculous. And in my mind, it looked ridiculous because it is. That's not the point of a sermon, is to give you more me. That's not what you need. No one woke up today in the midst of your struggles, in the midst of your challenges, wondering, is my life going to go where I want it to go? Am I going to be in the relationship I want to be in? Is God going to accomplish his purpose in life? None of you thought, I just need more Ben Stewart. I just need a witty line from him. I need something to rhyme. None of you thought that. You don't need me. You need Jesus. You need God to change your life, right? And let me tell you something. No one in your office was like, God, I just need more you. Gina, talk to me. No one needs more you. But God's given you gifts that when you use them, you'll feel a sense of purpose. God is using me. And as you use it to build a common good, a harvest of righteousness is grown in peace by those who sow in peace. You can do something amazing. You don't need selfish ambition. You need a holy ambition. That I want God to use my gifts to bless others. But you know what I had to do in that moment is I just had to acknowledge, you know what, God? I'm an adulterous person. I was trying to use your stage for my glory, and that's not what a stage is for. And I need to repent. You know what's great about that? We're meant to talk to him that way. He loves when we talk to him that way. Because the minute we confess, grace rushes in. Confession doesn't lead to destruction. It leads to redemption. Leads to him writing a new story. He opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. So submit yourselves, therefore, to God. That's the remedy. It's just to come to him and say, hey, I'm done trying to build my kingdom. I'm submitting to your kingdom. And it's interesting. He does a little inclusio in verses 7 to 10. He says, submit yourselves to God and then humble yourselves to the Lord. It's the same idea. And everything in the middle of that is just telling you kind of how to do it. Submit to the Lord. Humble yourselves before him. Hey, God, I'm yours. Just be honest to him. You don't have to try to fix you. Just be honest about where you're broken. And that's what he says here. Submit yourself to God. Resist the devil, and he'll flee from you. Don't believe everything you think. If you feel an intense emotional energy of jealousy and rivalry against somebody in here, your mind is just going to fill with all the reasons why they're horrible. Begin to question that. Where is this emotional energy coming from? Okay, they said something that hurt my feelings. What does the word of God say about how to remedy that? That I come to them humbly, I seek to reconcile. What's my goal in the conversation? If my goal is to reconcile, I have a Christian goal. If my goal is to destroy them, you ever had that kind of daydream of you being in an argument with someone at work and then you say something that everyone around you is like, ooh, and you're like, yeah, and then they explode and you're like, if you're dreaming like that, you adulterous people. There's something wrong with you. And the thing is, you got a selfishness in you that you just got to admit that. God, that's my problem. God, I got to change that. I don't want to live out of that. That's a destructive way to live. I want a holy way to live. So I'm going to resist thinking like that. I'm going to resist thoughts of revenge. I'm going to resist thoughts of vengeance. I'm not going to act like that. And he says, when you resist the devil, he will flee from you. The one with you is way more powerful than that. He says, but you draw near to God, and he'll draw near to you. He's not far from you. And so then he says, cleanse your hands, you sinner. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. He uses priest imagery. The priest used to have to wash their hands before they would lead in the temple. And it was supposed to be a physical picture of them cleansing their hearts. What I love about that is in the Old Testament, nobody walked into church with the assumption that I'm already pure and perfect. The priests themselves had to come in and wash their hands. And it was a symbol. I'm in need of cleansing. I'm a mess. No one's supposed to walk into church acting like they got it all together. That's the weirdest Christian mentality of, oh, I got to act like I got it all together in church. No, church is a place you admit you don't. And you come to a God who likes to purify dirty people. You come to a God who likes to heal broken people. You come to a God who restores. That's why he does it this way. So be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. It's not a particularly upbeat verse. You don't see verse 9 on a lot of coffee mugs. But his point there, now he's using prophetic imagery. The prophets in the Old Testament used to tell people that when you see the sin in your life, it's good to cry over that. I don't know why I'm insecure like that. I don't know why I'm like, I don't want to be that way. And when I confess that and weep it over it, man, God comes rushing in with grace. And some of you, you got an insecurity from some wounds from your parents, and it's come out and you being very insecure with us, and you've assumed motives about people in this room that they don't have. And you've said some cruel things based on some assumptions about their motives that you don't know, and you've been a divider, not a uniter, and you got to repent. And just to clear the air, I'm not thinking about anyone specifically. These are hypothetical situations. But I'm just saying, they're close to the truth for many of us. We've done this. And what we've got to do is say, hey, you know what? This is the world I'm in, and I got to weep over that. There's a broken part of me that's real sad. But the good news is, you're not too far gone. He gives more grace. And so humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you. I love that. He will lift you up. He really will. For me, I remember when I was in my 20s, I got to a point where I was a Christian leader, but I felt like I was hitting limits of just advancing. I wasn't advancing in getting out of some insecurity in my heart. I wasn't advancing in some of the outward leadership roles I wanted. I wasn't advancing as a human being. I felt stuck. And I remember I was sitting in the library one day and just praying. I was on campus. I was in college. And I was like, God, I just need to know my next step. And I felt like the Lord was like, you need to join a Bible study. And I was like, I do need a Bible study. And it's like, you should join Chris's Bible study. It was kind of a weird moment. It's not normal for me, but I was like, it felt very clear. I need to go talk to this guy, Chris, and join the Bible study he leads. And then I had this great resistance in my heart. I was like, no, Lord, I don't want to do that. Because Chris was kind of new in our friendship group. He was dating a girl that I was friends with, and I wasn't sure how I felt about him. And I was like, no, God, I need to be awesomer than Chris. Like, this is critical right now. Like, Ben needs to be. If I join his Bible study, I'm coming underneath him. The awesomeness index is going to get thrown off. I can't do that. And I just felt this real resistance. And then I realized, what's causing that resistance? Is it some immorality in Chris? I was like, no, it's in me. I'm insecure about submitting to somebody else. That's an internal thing. And I'm keeping myself from learning? I don't want to do that. And I felt like the Lord was pressing me, humble yourself. So I was like, I guess, God, I don't know. I wasn't super happy about that. But then the weirdest thing happened. I walked out of the library. Texas A&M has like 70,000 students on it. So being alone is uncommon. I walked out of the library. I was completely alone. I mean, literally, there was nothing but like some leaves blowing by in the wind. I'm like, well, this is eerie. And then around the corner comes Chris. And he's walking right towards me. And I'm like, no. And I remember he had the weirdest look on his face, and he walked straight to me, wasn't walking past me. He was like, hey, man, I know this is going to sound weird, but do you want to join the Bible study I lead? And I was like, yeah, man, I do. He's like, all right. I'm like, all right, fine. Okay, bye. Yeah, bye. And we both left. Super weird. But I went to that Bible study, and this guy was teaching me things I had never heard in my life. He was opening up scriptures, introducing me to authors that have completely influenced the way I think. He had the most gracious, natural way of apologizing. You know, if you never apologize, that says more about your arrogance than your perfection. Well, I would apologize. I just never make mistakes. No, that probably means you're insecure. He just had the easiest way of when he was guilty, he didn't shame himself. He wasn't like, I can't admit that because I'll admit what a failure I am. He'd be like, hey, man, not calling you back was rude. I apologize for that. That wasn't the right thing to do. Hey, man, I'm sorry. I misspoke there. I didn't. I think that came across the way. He just had the easiest way of apologizing and moving on. He just wasn't hung up by stuff. And I was like, man, there's such maturity to that. And I learned so much from this guy. He became a mentor and a friend. We were in each other's weddings, and he's a lifelong buddy. And my life was shaped by this man. I'm like, I'm so glad my pride didn't keep me from learning and growing from a guy like this. That humility led to exaltation. I'm a better minister, husband, and human being because I was under him. And yet I remember when I left there, I went to go lead a ministry, and the school I was at kind of gives the impression when you graduate from school, you should leave here and take over the world because you're a genius, right? They sort of taught us that as college kids. And I went into that youth ministry where I had 4 kids and 6 adults, and after a couple months had grown it to 1 kid and no adults. All the adults left and 1 kid stayed, little Austin Baldridge. And I remember I was so mad because I was like, God, I learned all this stuff and now you just give me 1 kid? I was so mad. I remember I was sitting there with this little middle school kid and I felt like the Lord pressed on my heart, Ben, do you love me? I was like, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said, then feed my sheep. 1 sheep. And really, I don't even know if I should trust you with Austin, right? Like, it's kind of a bad deal for him. And what I realized was happening in my heart is I didn't want to love Austin. I wanted to use Austin. And I resented him because he wasn't 100 kids. And that's dangerous in ministry. And that's why as a pastor, let me just say, where I protect the stage and protect who's our leaders, because I want to make sure, I want people that want to serve you, not use you. Too many people have been hurt by people in leadership positions who want to use you. You want to exalt people in leadership who want to serve you, right? It's keeping the wolves away. And so for me, I realized I'm trying to use this ministry to fill a vacancy in me. That's adulterous. That's evil. And I had to repent. And God changed my heart. And you know what the crazy thing was? I joyfully served as a nobody with these kids, and I loved it. Some of my favorite days in ministry, getting to walk in life with these middle school and high school kids. And then you know what happened? Years later, somebody called me to speak at a thing, and I spoke at it. And that led to getting called at a different thing to speak, and that led to a monthly thing to speak at, and then that monthly guy gave my name to this guy, and suddenly I was speaking at one of the largest Christian gatherings in Houston, Texas. And I remember pulling into that parking lot, and I started crying in the parking lot because I thought the me of 5 years ago would have wanted this so bad for all the wrong reasons. And thank God he kept that kid off the stage because I had nothing to offer those people. I just wanted to use him. But God had to make me submit, drive me into the dirt. And then when I humbled myself, he exalted me. Now that I had something to say. And I remember crying because I realized I don't care that I'm in the spotlight. All I care is I want to leverage that moment to help people. That's all I care about. And in that darkness, in that secret place, God had taught me that singleness was about devotion to God. And I wrote a sermon on that. And they told me, don't preach that. No one wants you to preach on singleness. And I preached on singleness and people liked it. And I wrote a book on it. And it is helping me pay the rent. So humble yourselves, and in due time, God will exalt you, right? And here's the good news. We won't have time to teach the rest. We got to get out of here. But I love it when he says, don't judge your brother. So let's not speak harshly to each other. Let's not be a church like that. Let's be somewhere else. And he says, you know who has the right to judge? He who can save and destroy. And just as a heads up, that's not you. He's talking about Jesus. Jesus is Lord over this earth, and when he says it's done, it's done. But he came to save, to rescue the lost. He had all the authority of heaven, and he stripped off every inconvenience to serve us. And he humbled himself to serve you and me. And he humbled himself to the point of death, even on the cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place. That's the king we follow. So it's weird to follow a humble king with arrogance. It's weird to follow a king who would humble himself to death, but then demand that my name be made great. That's not where our king is going. He humbled himself so he could live the perfect life you could not, so he could die the death you deserved. And God exalts him for that. And all who put their faith in him, we rise with him. And God's going to use you God's going to use your gifts. He's going to use your life. He's not going to waste you. He's not going to waste your hopes and dreams. He is going to guide you on his path and build his kingdom that lasts forever. Your little kingdom will fade and it will not be sufficient to change us. His kingdom goes on to forever and you can change the world when you're on board with him. You humble yourself and in the right time, he'll exalt you. He did it with Christ and he loves to do it with Christians. Trust him.
If you were encouraged by today's talk, be sure to rate us and hit subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you stream your podcasts. To experience other talks, videos, and live gatherings, visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com or download the Passion Movement app. And again, thanks for listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast.